You're listening to the best of Dave Fanning on 2FM.
That's right, it is indeed. Dave Fanning here again today, taking a look back over some of the many interviews that we did in the programme over the past year. Let's get going with this next one. Last month marked the 250th anniversary of the composer Beethoven's birth. Earlier in the year, I asked conductor David Brophy to drop into the studio to talk about Beethoven's influence on modern music. Let's jump in here. Now, I know we're on, how shall I put this, Kardashian radio, more or less. So David Brophy, if you start getting all kind of lyric on me, we're not going to get this one. David Brophy is here, by the way, because this year marks the 250th birthday, or so they say anyway, of the composer Beethoven. I'm not sure if it's 100% correct. Anyway, he's been called the most influential musician ever, whose legacy lives on today, basically. So conductor extraordinaire, David Brophy is here now to talk about the man and his music, and you're going to have to make it pretty easy, okay?
You mean it is easy?
Okay, I'll tell you what. Is he the greatest musician ever, David Brophy?
I can't. So I'm not going to say that. That's a trap. You're going to lead me down a cul-de-sac. I'm not going to say that. But he certainly was a key person in the development of music. And there's a lot of stuff we have today in all sorts of music. You think of all the types of music we have today that would probably be difficult to imagine were it not for Beethoven, I think.
Can I take a look at some pieces, first of all, before we get into the man and try to put him somewhere? I mean, I'm going to say Beethoven is jazz. Why am I saying that, and what is this piece? We're going to take it through other pieces of music, in other words.
Well, maybe it's better that I'll just play the music first, because the music speaks for itself, I think.
Oh, right. Oh, wow. David's going all kind of weird on this
today. Okay. It's true, though.
Do you know, you mentioned the two words, Joplin and Scott, a few minutes ago. God, I can see it all,
yeah,
right. Yeah. So tell me about that. What are we talking about here?
That's the last part of his very last piano sonata, written about maybe 6-7 years before he died, written in, I think, 1820. And he was completely deaf when he wrote that. So he'd gone profoundly deaf. His deafness started from the mid-20s, and he was deaf by the age of 44.
Well, by the mid-20s, you mean his age, mid-20s?
His mid-20s. Oh. About 26, he started going deaf. And so he wrote that when he was completely deaf. And that was written at a time when we hadn't a clue about swing,
right,
or jazz or funky stuff, and it just sounds to me, every time I listen to it, I go, how did he write
in
the 1820s? Where did that come from?
Where did that come from?
It just came from
Did he spend a few days in New Orleans?
New Orleans, no. I don't know where it came from, but there's something in that you kind of listen to that and go, God, that guy was 100 years ahead. Like, because there was nobody wrote anything like that throughout the next 80, 90 years, really, and it was only until probably the end of the 19th century where we got that kind of style of piano playing and writing.
Okay, well then, these musical examples are giving us a kind of an idea of the first question that we were asking there, so let's just keep going with that for a second. I'm going to play him here from Saturday Night Fever. Okay, first things first, David. The purist in you is not retching, I see. Love it.
No, I don't know what the pure I don't know what purism is.
I love it. I'm going to get him. I'll trip him up before the end.
You trip me. Go on, trip me up. I don't know what purism or purity is.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that was written by Walter Murphy in 1976, I think, a year before Saturday Night Fever, and it's from the films, an iconic scene in the film where John Travolta walks into the nightclub and he's strutting his stuff and he's accompanied by this music, and it just takes the opening da 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 dum from the Fifth Symphony. It's the first bit of the Fifth Symphony, and even that little idea, like, before Beethoven wrote his Fifth Symphony, most composers would write ideas that had 15 notes, 20 notes, 25 notes, and they go on and go on and go on and go on. Beethoven was the first composer to take little small cells of notes, 4 notes, 5 notes, 6 notes maximum, what we would probably call nowadays a riff, something very small, and no composers had written like that up until the 1800s. The early
so you're telling me he invented ragtime with a bit of jazz in there. He invented the riff, which later on
I'm
Eric
not
Clapton.
He invented anything. He wrote this stuff that I think that kind of predates the real thing that we know nowadays. And I think his genius is caught up on that.
Right.
And I think certainly the notion of like the Fifth Symphony is ba 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 bam over and over and over again. And this notion of a small idea that you easily remember. Everyone remembers that. Like there's even small kids, 3-year-olds, you play ba 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 bam. They go, they know what that is.
And that was unusual in the time.
No one wrote like so. The composers before Beethoven, like Haydn and Mozart and Bach, they all wrote longer phrases that like took 10 notes, 12 notes, 15 notes to get their idea out. Beethoven got the idea out in a small amount of time and repeated it over and over again. And he also, it made it dramatic. His music is dramatic, and foremost.
Okay, well now we're going to go all the way. You ready for a bit
all
of Beethoven rap? Okay, that is Nas. So tell me, what do you think about that?
I love it. I mean, if you can see the video online, there's a small girl playing a very small upright piano in a kind of what looks like wasteland area on the outskirts of some major urban area in America, and she plays for Elise, Beethoven's famous piano piece that anybody who's gone to piano lessons has probably tried at some stage to pick out. And he uses the whole thing. Actually, it doesn't just stop with that little riff. He actually uses the whole piece. Is used all the way through his whole track, and it's amazing. Like how I think Beethoven permeates popular culture.
Yeah.
But to hear it in that context, you wouldn't have kind of expect that. And I think that just shows. I mean, it not only shows. I think. The universality of just his ideas, the notes he wrote down. But I think even nowadays, musicians from all sorts of cultures are open to Beethoven. He's on everyone's radar. Any musician who's worth their salt, no matter what they play, trad, rock, jazz, funk, whatever the hell it is, they've got some idea who Beethoven was and the type of tunes he wrote. And they live on.
And starting out in piano class... Yeah, there it is. Minus Nas. Okay, that's for Elise, and that's from when? Like from the middle? Like, if he had, what periods did he have? Did he have kind of pre-1800, a little bit after 1800, and then the last bit?
He was born in 1770, so that was written, I think, around 1810, I think, was when that
was. So he
was
well into it by then, and he was deaf by then.
He was deaf by 44, so it was 1814, he was fully deaf at that stage. He was nearly deaf at that stage. And that piece wasn't found until after he died.
Oh, really?
So it wasn't published in his lifetime. People didn't know about it. It was written a private piece. He would have written pieces for... He taught piano. So a lot of composers prior to that would work in courts and work for royalty and get their money that way. But Beethoven was kind of keen to be his own man. So he taught piano to a lot of obviously wealthy people. And he wrote small pieces for a lot of his female students. And we think that was a piece for Elise. It was written for somebody called Elise. But it was found 40 years after he died.
Okay, well then let's take it up to something else, which is, how shall I put it? If I said Beethoven in rap and Saturday Night Fever and jazz, Beethoven in politics. Where do we go with that exactly?
This is the Ninth Symphony and this is the Ode to Joy, which... Beethoven was connected with politics his whole life. He wrote his Third Symphony, which was originally dedicated to Napoleon, his Eroica Symphony.
But then he didn't like him, did he?
Yeah, he found out Napoleon kind of crowned himself emperor and he scribbled out the Eroica dedication
and
to Napoleon.
Somebody I remember something about it when he scribbled it out, the pen went through the page.
Very good, Dave.
In anger.
I like it.
In anger.
You've gone on lyric on me is what you've gone here. What are you talking about me going lyric on you?
He said, to hell with this Napoleon guy.
That's impressive, yeah. He dug his pen right through the manuscript and buried a hole right in the manuscript. He was so annoyed at the notion that Napoleon crowned himself emperor.
Well, here it is, then. And this is, by the way, the European National Anthem. Is that what it's called? For the European Union?
Yeah, they adopted it in 1972.
All right. And it's every year it's part of something. Does it open
actually,
something?
It was played, like the opening of Parliament last summer, it was famously played by a group of young musicians on the floor of the Parliament in Brussels, but all the Brexit party turned their back.
Did they now?
What is that? Right, so that says the effect of Beethoven.
All right, well, here we go.
Other things.
Thank you. FM, the home of the hits.
I love it.
Yeah, that was David Brophy there putting me through my paces with a speed lesson on Beethoven. Now, the song Something by the Beatles, Wonderful Tonight by Eric Clapton, and Layla by Derek and the Dominoes were all written about one woman, and that's Patty Boyd. But it's actually not Patty I want to talk about now, but instead it's her sister, Jenny. Jenny Boyd joined me on the programme a couple of months back on the release of her autobiography, Jennifer Juniper. And like Patty, Jenny was right there in the heart of the swinging 60s scene. She married Mick Fleetwood not once, by the way, but twice. And she went to India with the Beatles to spend time with the Maharishi. Not only that, one of the biggest hit makers of the 1960s, Donovan, wrote a song about her and called it Jennifer Juniper. I asked Jenny firstly about the experience of being in India.
To go to the ashram and have our meditation, have our mantra, it was amazing. It was really incredible. And then, of course, at that time, our bungalow, because everybody, sort of groups of people, had their own bungalows. You know, we'd sit on the roof, and George and Paul and John would be there with their guitars and just playing, strumming, coming up with new songs and ideas and everything that was going on in our life at that time. So it could be John not sleeping or Prudence or Bungalow Bill. You know, it was kind of just they were singing what was actually going on.
But also, you know, the Sgt. Pepper's album, the opening of Side 2 in the old vinyl days, was a song called Within You, Without You by George Harrison. Did you give George, were you reading some Hindi scripts, or had you got some influence on that song?
Yes, well, I'll tell you how it happened. We would go to this friend's house, a whole bunch of us, our little gang, and we'd all sit round the table and, you know, everyone would have smoke a bit of weed and listen to just great music. And it was, music was everything. But we didn't really talk to each other because we would just sit there and listen to music. And I remember picking up this book on the table called Karma and Rebirth by someone called Christmas Humphreys. And I was just flicking through the pages and then I saw this line that said, life goes on within you and without you. And I just thought, wow, you know, that's amazing. So I call Patty and George, and George answers the phone, and I just said, listen to this. Life goes on within you and without you. And he got it as well. And then afterwards, that's where the song came from.
One of the things is, I'm going to play a little piece of a song now, because it's the title of the book, and it's very relevant too. This is Donovan with Jennifer Juniper.
Jennifer Juniper upon the hill. Jennifer, Juniper, sitting very still. Is she sleeping? I don't think so. Is she breathing? Yes, very low. What you doing, Jennifer, my love? Jennifer, Juniper, right.
There you go. Jennifer Juniper is the name of the song from Donovan, of course, and a man who had about 400 top 10 hits between about 65 and 70. Right in the middle of all that is one of those ones, and that's that one there. And it is Jennifer Juniper that we're talking to here, because that's the name of the book as well. And Jenny Boyd, you were working in, what was it? Was it one of the Beatles shops or something in 68 or thereabouts?
Yeah, it was the Apple Boutique. We'd all been to Bangor in Wales and got our mantra and spent time with Maharishi. And Maharishi said, yes, you know, he wanted us all to go to India. Well, George asked me, would you go to India with us? And he and Patty. And so while I was waiting to go to India, there was about 2-3 months. And so they'd just opened up the Apple Boutique. So they wanted me to manage it with this guy, Pete Shotton, who was one of John Lennon's friends.
Oh, yeah.
And it was great fun. And then one day, Donovan arrived, and I'd met him before, and we started talking about meditation in San Francisco, and, you know, he was obviously kind of on the search as well. The second time we got together, he said, I've got a song for you, and I've written a song. So I sat down opposite him, and he's looking into my eyes as he's singing Jennifer Juniper, and I was very shy at that time. I didn't quite know where to look. And also because it showed how he felt about me, and I wasn't sure, quite what was happening.
Yeah.
But I loved it. I thought it was so beautiful. And I think that song has stayed with me for over 50 years. And it's one of those songs that it feels like it's mine. But not only that, it represents that time. You know,
of course,
it represents the
innocence. Of course,
the idealism, we can change the world. And it's beautiful and romantic and, you know, all those things.
Well, I mean, all the stories we're talking about here now, obviously in the book, as are, like, you know, you're the third of four kids. There's Nairobi in Kenya, the wealthy expat scene. Not that you were necessarily wealthy within that. And a fascinating story about your dad being the handsome World War II pilot and crashed just before the wedding to your mother. And you describe him kind of as a disfigured and traumatized husband. And your mum left because of his philandering and a lot of stuff going on, basically. And then you're coming back and forth and whatever. But the point is, do you think in any way at all that, you know, that you've often found in the past that you were too largely defined by the men in your life?
Yeah, I do. It was difficult, and especially when, because Mick would like me going on the road with him and, you know, with the Fleetwood Mac in the early days when Peter was there and later. But it was a night, at that time we had two young children. And it was difficult because I was there because I was Mick's wife. And I didn't really chat much to the others because I didn't really drink at that time and I was shy and I was just looking, I was the mum, you know, looking after the kids. And whether we'd be driving through, you know, through different parts of America just in a car because it was, you know, everything was done on the cheap then. I just hoped that the kids wouldn't make any sound because everybody's tired. So it was... I was there just for Mick. And then after a while, hotel after hotel, I'd just have to go home. So I didn't feel a sense of my own identity for a long time, for a number of years.
And that was Jenny Boyd talking to me about her autobiography, Jennifer Juniper.
You're listening to the best of Dave Fanning on 2FM.